Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Barry Stevens, a documentary filmmaker whose feature work includes Offspring, Prosecutor, and Undercover Jihadi. He also made the television series War Story for the History Channel. He's currently working on another feature, Toy Stories, about labor abuse in the production of children's toys around the world. Barry picked 2001: A Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick's revolutionary, revelatory look at where we've been and where we might be going, an unprecedented, beautifully executed vision that remains unmatched half a century later, stretching from the dawn of man to the next stage in our evolution, which may or may not be tied to the appearances of a mysterious monolith. It's an auteurist masterpiece that's impossible to discuss without veering into metaphor and symbolism, which means we'll probably never stop discussing it. Its influence is everywhere, including the artwork for this show. And on the occasion of its 50th anniversary, and this Friday's arrival of an IMAX 70mm version for the first time ever, it felt like time to make our own voyage through it. This is someone else's movie.
When I speak to, I've been speaking to a couple of people about it in anticipation of talking to you.
Oh, nice.
And younger people. And they say, well, it was boring. And you know, there are aspects of it, certainly. I mean, my God, it's dated. In a way, the datedness is interesting in that it's a window into another time of the way the world was seen, which is cool. And then sometimes perhaps it's just dated, but Kubrick was obsessed with detail, and you feel it. You feel it in the film. You feel it in everything that's in that film. That's always so well researched and so meticulous. There may be wrong choices. The view may be wrong. Whatever, but that remains. When I saw it again the other night,
yeah, I love the idea of futurism as history. Like the thing that you were saying, right. Like in a way the film feels dated, and it is, because it's the work of someone in 1968 trying to predict what 2001 would look like,
yeah.
And you get that sense of kind of the space age optimism that even though, yes, computers are turning on us, we have computers and we have telephone screens and we have Pan Am is flying to the moon on a regular basis, and even though this is clearly a charter flight because Haywood Floyd's the only one on it, there's all these wonderful little ideas of, if things progress along a certain point, this is where we'll end up. And every single science fiction movie set in the near or not too distant or general future is always going out on a limb with these things. And what 2001 did was present its future design with such authority.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the pacing comes in, because you have time to look at all these pieces and how they work and appreciate mm-hmm. what we have created, which mm-hmm. is all, you know, coming back to the bone in the sky. It's all human innovation based on whatever spark we witnessed as an audience. I'm going to jump all over, clearly. But the sense that Kubrick had was that we were going to be, like, we're working together, everything's going to be okay. You know, it wasn't until later that when I first saw it, I was a kid, I was five, probably.
Mm.
In 1973, it was definitely a re-release. I saw it probably in 70mm, definitely at the Eglinton.
Oh, so you were born in 68?
68, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So
just
it's
a few months later.
Yeah, you were born the same year as the movie.
Yeah.
That's funny.
I'm a star child.
Yes.
But yeah, no, it's a weird thing to be tied to, because it was released in April. I was born in August, and, you know, you just have that little ping in the back of your brain every time you see your birth year on anything.
Yes.
And so 2001 has always been associated with me, and it's always just really easy to figure out how far back or how far ahead we are.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it's the amount of time between the end of the First World War and the release of 2001 A Space Odyssey is equal to the amount of time since, which is somehow, I cannot grasp that.
It's inconceivable, isn't it? It's...
But the business about the technology and the way we imagine the future is interesting. When I see it, I imagine young people seeing it we'll see those screens on the back of the Pan Am shuttle going to the space wheel and see these little flat screens on the back of the seats, which, of course, are part of our life every day. And that was completely unknown. That was not, maybe people talked about it, but nobody had ever, I don't think it ever realized that, it ever put that in a film. So now people see it and just don't see that that's exciting in the future.
Yeah.
And of course, every one of those had to be rear projected from, I think, 16mm film.
Yeah. It's
and all these projectors running. And all those panels they had in the spaceship, every one of them had to be projected. They had these great rigs of projectors going.
Which I love looking at now because it's soothing to me. All these blinking screens that look like film instead of video. I mean, they were, but there's that aspect of it now.
Yeah, that's true. And I remember the first time I ever was aware of the film, I remember I was in San Francisco.
Well, I was going to say, because it's always something that comes up. What was your first exposure to it? When did you...
Well, I was in San Francisco with my family and just walked by a shop and there was a poster saying, from the Earth to Beyond, a great journey, or something bland. But it had this image of the wheel, the space station, which is in orbit around the Earth, and the rocket coming out of it, which never happened in the movie with the Pan Am clip. Yeah. It was art. It wasn't a photograph. And I was instantly, I really want to see that. It was almost like I was counting the amount of time before it came out. Because I was an immigrant kid from England to Winnipeg and not very happy then. And movies were really, it's a probably the most important thing in my life in a way. I mean, books too, but it was really significant.
Was it the escape? Is it from whatever you say you weren't happy?
Escape, but also excitement about future, about the possibilities. And there are always a few films, if you're a filmmaker, where you think, oh, wow, I'd really like to make something that was like, make something in this form, to be a master of that world. And that was, I think, for everybody, there's those films. For me, it was the spectacles. It was Lawrence of Arabia in that period, although Lawrence was 5 years earlier, maybe. Dr. Zhivago.
Right. So the big road shows.
Yeah, the big road show film. Yeah, the films that had like intermission in the middle.
Yeah,
which is so pretentious somehow, but it's like a big theater, you know, like a theatrical show where you have an intermission.
And for a three and a half hour movie, that was a kindness. That was acceptable that people would get up and go to the bathroom or refill their popcorn or something.
I think War and Peace had two or three.
Yes,
you know, Sergei Bondarchuk's.
Yeah, it's an 8 hour presentation, right?
Something like 6, 5, 7. Yeah, yeah, I don't know.
I just remember it being very, very long.
I'd love to see it again. But anyway, so that used to, and Kubrick, well, just to return to my personal experience, and I went to see it, and from that first shot, which once again is, look at it, it's like, it's on the verge of being in a sort of ironic culture we live in now. It's easy to sneer at the sort of these three planets lining up and this incredibly dramatic music, which was totally new to me. I'd never listened to Richard Strauss then.
I only ever knew it as the music from 2001.
Yeah.
I mean, by the time I was five, culturally it had already been taken over.
That's right.
By the movie?
Well, I think it has. I think it's associated with that, and it's used in parodies all the time.
Man.
Mike Nichols used it in Catch 22 when the woman appears, and it's used various places. I'm sure The Simpsons have used it.
Oh, yeah.
But
Pensacola. They recreate the entire Donna Mann sequence, and the monolith is a soft drink dispenser.
Really?
Yeah, the first or second season. I remember that vividly.
That's great. Yeah, and then you have this dawn of man. Is it important to for the sake of your broad the podcast to lay out the story of the movie?
If the people listening don't know 2001 at this point, there is literally nothing we can do for them. No, I don't think so. I mean, and with 2001, I mean, ultimately it's all theoretical anyway. You can talk about the sequenced events, but what it means is why we're here. Like that's something else entirely.
And normally I hate movies where, oh, could mean anything. It's your interpretation. Mm. Like, fuck off. It's like, you know, you have a responsibility as an artist to know what you're saying.
Yeah.
At least somehow.
I think there's... I mean, I have a theory, and I'm pretty sure I'm right, so we can get to that.
What would you say is your...
I think, in that 2001 is a film of sequences, beginning as, you know, we can break it in, beginning at the dawn of man, moving on to the discovery of the monolith on the moon, and then culminating in the Jupiter Stargate sequence. I think that it is the story of humanity, I mean, ultimately, and the evolution of mankind, humankind, into whatever form we're going towards. And what Kubrick is doing is positioning the monolith. I don't think the monolith stimulates evolution. A lot of people think that once the once the apes touch the monolith in the first sequence, that that gives them the idea.
That's what I think, yeah.
And it's, there is a montage that suggests it.
Yeah.
But I think the monolith is there to witness our points and be a watermark for humanity. If we can get to the moon, we find one. If we can go to Jupiter, it's waiting for us. And the signal is designed to maybe lead us there, or we're innovative enough to figure that out the same way that in the beginning the apes figure out how to use tools. And I think that's what it is. I think it's about...
So the monolith is witnessing it rather than leading it?
Yeah. I think, well, I mean, the original title of the short story was The Sentinel,
Yes.
Not The Guide. So I've always assumed, I think, that that's where it goes.
It was a trigger to warn, in a sense, the aliens that we have reached that point.
Now, the only problem with my theory is that whatever happens at the very end to David Bowman is the monolith. Like, it's clearly doing something to his aged body.
Well, it is the Stargate that he goes through.
Mm-hmm. And then at the end, it's present when he mutates into whatever embryonic Starchild thing comes out. So. Yes. That's tricky, but I think maybe that's what happens when you reach the aliens, when you reach the intelligence. We have proven ourselves worthy of going on to the next step. Now, I'm an optimist, and I want to believe that he's not being tortured and murdered in a spacesuit.
Oh, I see, like with anal rectal probes going up. No, I never think
of the horrors that we see it as a series of impulses or images for you, but it's not. Like, I don't think that... I think that's not representational of what's really happening.
But it's true about the optimism, and I don't think you see that nowadays in much art. Am I wrong? I don't think so. I mean, it's sort of...
That's not where we are right now. Right?
No, and that was the same year that Apollo 8 went up, and they took that first picture of the Earth with the moon in the foreground. And that picture was, you probably know, suppressed by NASA.
I did not know.
I think, the government felt, and I hope I've got this right, but I believe the government felt that it was too one-world-ish. They're in the middle of a bitter cold war with the Soviet Union, or they thought, and that atmosphere, paternalistic secrecy, is buried, is right in the movie, because they say that, it would be culturally, I can't remember what Heywood Floyd says when he speaks to the people in that strange chamber on the moon, something like it's going to be, you know, culturally disorienting and sociologically damaging and all this stuff. And they don't even imagine sending a mission to Jupiter and not telling the crew why they're going. It actually doesn't make a lot of sense. Yeah. But what Hitchcock called an icebox problem, right?
You figure it out later when you
go get a beer out of the icebox. Yeah. But at the time, it works.
Yeah, and it's still... And even a movie like Alien, which just picks up that same theme of blue-collar workers who really don't have any idea what their larger purpose is, echoes it nicely. I just always assume that with...
That's true.
With the two astronauts who are conscious and active, Bowman and I can never remember.
Poole.
Thank you, Frank Poole. Bowman and Poole are the drivers. They are on their way to do a thing.
They're driving the bus. Yeah.
Whatever it is will be revealed to them, which is great. But then you find out that there's a secret message all along in case of panic and computer malfunction. So, they're simply not being trusted with the truth, whatever the truth is.
Yeah. And that's also a product of the time, I think, of that sort of paternalism. But it's still optimistic. And you know, when the Apollo 11... astronauts, I think it was 11, any of the first people on the moon, they were asked what it was like. One of them said it was like 2001. So that feeling of space, which I don't think I felt was sort of betrayed or it was abandoned, and not in a good way, with subsequent movies. Alien is a terrific... It's one of the few movies where the alien really... I mean, the guy in the spaceship they find who's heart is torn out is one of the few times you really feel that's different. That's not, because most aliens just look like they're less interesting than creatures you find near the bottom of the sea.
Yeah, they're just generally people in suits or puppets or whatever.
Yeah,
whatever we could realize on a cheap basis.
Exactly.
As humans,
Arrival is an exception.
Sure,
but And that's why in the end, I think Clarke and Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, the screenwriter, didn't want to portray aliens because they kept trying and it just looked stupid.
Yeah. And what they came up with was so much more unnerving. And I'm glad you brought up Arrival because it's the only other film I can think of that is simultaneously about the impossibility of communicating with an alien intelligence, and about the impossibility of rendering an alien creature.
Yeah.
Because we're always going to bring it back to something we kind of understand.
But he did render them in
the test. Villeneuve. Yeah, he did, and it still kind of looked like.
You know, oh really?
The heptapods sort of look like. I mean, I love it, but
I thought they were good.
They're recognizable. We understand them.
Yeah, yeah.
And the idea with 2001's aliens is that they gave up trying because the emphasis was on incomprehensibility.
Yeah.
We can't, like, not only can we not understand what their motivations are, we can't see them. They're not visible to us as the theater goer and as Bowman.
Yeah.
And those noises are just so, I mean, Kate won't watch the film again.
Really?
My wife and I have just been feuding is pushing it, but I got very excited about the 70mm IMAX release yesterday that was announced.
Yeah, and it's going to be showed at
Cinesphere.
At Cinesphere in Toronto.
Fact, this episode will be dropping that week, so people will be surprised. Go see it. It's playing in 4 locations. I'll mention it in the top and tag. But they're bringing an IMAX 70mm presentation in, and Kate's first response was like, "Nope, I'm busy. Do something else."
Why?
We saw it in 70mm at the Lightbox a few years ago. And she found the sound design so, I think, assaultive. Like, she just was physically uncomfortable in the second half of the movie.
Yeah, I can see that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It doesn't affect me that way, and I completely respect it.
Do you mean the Stargate sequence?
All of it.
Really?
It probably started before that. It probably started with the silence of space during the rescue mission after Poole is disconnected.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's an extraordinary sequence.
Mm.
And in fact, that's what I was meaning about how it's been abandoned, because part of that sound design is not just the sound design, but the slowness of it and the incredible silence of space and the vastness of it. And in a sense of, I'd even say the boredom of it is conveyed so powerfully that you have that feeling of that's what space is. When I look up in the night sky, that's what I see, the awfulness of it, the vast emptiness, the terrifying emptiness of it, the inhumanity of it. And that's what I find missing from almost every other sci-fi movie, every other space movie, and particularly with silence, because people say, I went on the web to look at what's the justification for everything going in space as they do in Star Wars. And people say, well, people need sound. So people need sound, but that means they're rejecting the reality of what space is, because space is utterly silent, of course. Sure. There's no sound, there's no air. But the dramatic possibilities of that are so great. The famous sequence when Bowman fires himself into the emergency entrance,
the
airlock, and it's he has all these sounds going off in the space bar, like vroom, 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 and it's really scary. I find it scary anyway, and I saw it just recently again and was transfixed. And then he explodes out, and it's absolutely silent. And the cut from very loud sound to silence is so powerful.
Yeah. Oh, no, the use of silence is something that... and Kubrick was, again, just scientific accuracy. He wanted it to feel as real as possible in imagining this impossible journey. But what you get is the absolute sense of cinematic control in the silence.
Yes.
In the lack of sound. Yes, it's a representation of what it would be like, but it also absolutely focuses you on the screen. You start looking harder to see what's going on, because we're denied that half of the experience.
Yes.
And Lucas's argument for Star Wars was always that, you know, sound is half the experience, and I want people to feel the action and experience the full velocity of the ships flying around. It's like, fine, but you're making World War II dogfight movies. That's like
absolutely
that's what he's doing. And Star Wars
westerns
would be far
and
less.
All these different. He just throws all these genres. It's a very different thing.
Exactly. It's more like a fantasy adventure than hard science fiction. And I'm perfectly fine with that. I think whatever, it's Star Wars. They're, those things exist outside the realm of arguable science fiction.
But yeah, it's, you know, Asimov's, I can't remember the exact phrase, but it's the three phases of science fiction. One is adventure dominant, and the next is technology dominant, and the third is society dominant, or, you know, human dominant. And and Star Wars is very much of the first. And I think that most sci-fi now is not real sci-fi. It's adventure films and comic books and so forth.
Yeah.
Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror is one of the few things that's come along that is actually real science fiction.
Yeah. But the problem with Black Mirror is that it always, it, just by creating the frame that it's created for itself, it's always just like, aha, look, whatever it is going to be bad. It's going to, there's no...
Except for San Junipero,
Yeah, which is sweet. And it's the only one, it's the only one with real empathy for its characters, I find. Everybody else is just, it's the Twilight Zone sting where whatever you thought was going to be accomplished will simply turn back in on the protagonist. So now, four seasons in, I'm just waiting for the reveals. And I find myself increasingly less interested in investing in the stories.
Is it coming again?
Oh, they'll make more. Yeah, Netflix never lets anything die. I think there'll be another one.
Yeah. Yeah, well, maybe he'll go into... you know, reproductive technology or something a little more interesting than just implants in the head.
Yeah, it'll be clones. It'll always be clones. Clones are cheap. You just get the same actor.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's, yeah, that sense of the use of silence, but also the, just talking about Bowman firing into the emergency, airlock is one of two cuts in the film that is, I think, one of the most, two of the most extraordinary cuts in movie history. The other one, of course, is the bone. Moonwatcher, I think his name. His bone goes flying up in the air, turns around, and becomes a spaceship. That's one of the most joyful moments for me in cinema when I saw it the first time, and every time. It's just this... yeah, basically, once we learn how to use tools, everything else is a refinement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's there's something quite funny about that. It's quite comic. It sort of summarizes human history in one cut.
Yeah.
And I find that really delightful. And then starts this whole waltz with this very 19th century, you know, music going on, and very much looking back in a sense to the Industrial Revolution. I mean, I'm just making it sound very intellectual. It's just a very satisfying and slightly humorous and obviously very sexual imagery of spaceship penetrating this large rock. And there's all this sexual imagery. The discovery ship looks like a spermatozoa, but it never feels like it's intellectually imposed. The enormous reality of the spectacle is so overwhelming, and I really want to see it again in 70mm. It's so overwhelming that I mean, you know, films, was it Lucas said, films are binary, they either work or they don't. And this one, for all its, you know, step back and criticize it, for all its flaws, it's so overwhelming, I think, in its imagery and its originality that it just, it kind of takes you over.
Yeah, I have always wondered what it would have been like to pitch it in the first place. And I know it went through all the different iterations, Journey Beyond the Stars or Journey Beyond the Sun, whatever they called it at first. And
yeah, it's a really terrible title.
Yeah. I got to talk to Douglas Trumbull about it a couple of times over the years.
Oh, really?
And, yeah. And he's, you know, well, we did this in a tank and we did this over there. The first effects for the film were just conceived, the cloud tank effects, the stuff they worked with for the...
Slit screen, yes.
Yeah. Those were developed... in a walk-up on 72nd Street in New York City.
Polaris films.
The smallest rooms, these little warehouse spaces above bakeries and restaurants, and the idea that you're going to create something that will literally change the way people see cinema.
Yeah.
And you start in the smallest, kind of clumsiest way to refine that vision into what this film became. It's an experimental movie in its second half. It is remarkable that this was sent out into the world as an MGM 70mm Cinerama roadshow event.
Yeah, what a risk.
But yeah, now we simply accept, you say 2001 and everybody has their image of it, but that language was, like, it didn't exist.
Well, I think there was experimental filmmakers, a guy called Jordan Belson, who did these experimental films that look like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Pauline Kael taking a swipe at... the critic of the New Yorker, of 2001 saying, oh, Jordan Belson does this stuff better. But I don't think that's, I guess, crap. It was, and it was those effects that I'm not sure what's Trumbull's and what's the other guy's, Wally Beavers or something.
Beavers, yeah.
Yeah. What they did, what Trumbull did, what the others did. But originally, Kubrick was really taken with this Canadian film, the National Film Board of Canada film called Universe, which used this technique where you have a clear paint thinner can or a glass jar, and then you drop various paints in it and film it with lots of light in slow-mo and created these starbursts and so forth. And he was like, wow, this is really good. And tried to hire them, but they didn't want to work with him. There's the other Canadian connection, of course. Your podcast doesn't really care about Canadian connections.
No, it's always valid.
But of course, is Douglas Rain, who narrated Universe. And Kubrick kept thinking, I want somebody who sounds like that. And he kept hiring Martin Balsam people. And ended up with Douglas Rain, who really, Canadian actor, apparently resented the fact that he's become most famous for the two-day job.
Yeah, and a monotone. If you're an actor, the last thing you want to be known for is your lack of range.
Yeah, but it's a great character, Hal. I mean, watching it the other day, you realize he's slightly flirtatious. He's sort of slightly, not camp, but he's a little bit, don't you think there's something strange about this mission, Dr. Bowman?
He insinuates.
Yeah, and it says, like, oh, you're working up to a psychology report, says Bowman. He says, well, of course I am. And he says, I think you should take a stress pill. And he's very, and of course he turns out to be one of the great, you know, great villains in movie history.
I honestly don't know if Hal's a villain. That's what I continue to love about the
really?
Character. Yeah. I think that the other thing about 2001 is, in the same way that it refuses to give us aliens that we can understand, I think the other thing that Clark is doing in his script is saying that when we make a computer that is our equal, our greatest mistake is thinking that it'll think like we do.
Yeah.
And I think Hal is, I mean, yes, 2010 has that whole explanation of why it happens. Mm. I think it's better if the whole thing comes from Hal's inability to reconcile the blown sensor thing. The idea that that's the thing he becomes fixated on, the sensor that doesn't fail, that he detects.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything else is an overreaction, an overcompensation from a logic machine that cannot understand a mistake.
Right.
That's so much more disturbing to me.
And he chooses...
He kills everyone. He's just like, this happened. You will not tell me it didn't. And then he just gradually murders everyone in his way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Finds excuses, finds ways to do it. It's far more disturbing to me to think that my phone is plotting against me than...
And of course, he's become, whenever anyone discusses it, and it's become much more of a discussion now, like one of the two areas where it feels very modern is in the AI, artificial intelligence, world, and also the Stargate sequence and the use now psychedelics coming back and being talked about as therapeutic tools and you know, pot's going to be legal in this country, and it's those things feel present, but especially AI in the. Whenever anyone talks about, oh, the computers could plot against us, they'll talk about Terminator, I guess.
Skynet comes up a lot.
But Hal and Skynet are the two things that people talk about.
Sure.
Always.
Hal is sort of the clean version of Skynet. He's not going to nuke you. He's going to trick you. He's going to just suggest that you take the stress pill or go check something in the ship and then disconnect you and cut your tether and... It's worse. It's more insidious because he never breaks character. He's always very calm and very thoughtful, and he pretends that he cares. Skynet just wipes us out.
Yeah, Skynet is just evil,
straight out. Yeah, exactly.
And Hal is neurotic or messed up and confused, and
he cares too much.
Yeah,
that's it. That's what he would say.
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
Yeah, is defensiveness in the most disturbing way to me.
Yeah, I think that's true. He's the scene where he kills Poole
yeah.
and and Poole goes flying off into space. You never see it. You never see the actual murder. And you never see the point of death. It's just this terribly meaningless death. Vonnegut had a line about it. The great adventure of the Outward Bound and going into space is it's boredom and meaningless death. That's what space brings us.
Yeah.
And Vonnegut, of course, is very dark about those things and very, very, you know, very, I think, very clear-eyed about it. But it has that feeling, Poole's death when he's flying away, and then Bowman coming in. And I mean, people say it's an inhuman movie, but it's a cold movie, mm-hmm. which it is. But Bowman trying to get back into the spaceship, that famous scene, you know, open the pod bay doors, Hal, which has become one of the great lines of movie history.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that. And his eyes, the lights on Bowman's, on Keir Delay's eyes, and they're darting back and forth. You can see every thought as he's calculating, as he's finally realizing how serious the situation is, mm-hmm. that the computer is trying to kill him, and how he's going to get out of it. And it's extraordinary. Yeah. And very much, there's great acting in the film, actually, because not only Keir Delay and Gary Lockwood is... Frank Poole. Apparently he came up with the idea of them going into the space pod. That was Gary Lockwood's idea.
To speak quietly.
Yeah, to speak quietly, and then somebody else came up with the idea of reading lips. But those performances, which are I think, really fantastic. Also Dan Richter, who plays the lead ape, and the other, and he was a mime and trained them all. Yeah. And the poor guy who did the makeup, Freeborn. Yeah. Course never got recognized for it, and
Planet of the Apes got the honorary Oscar that year,
and they snuck onto the set. Apparently they had a spy on the set.
The Planet of the Apes,
yeah, the Planet of the Apes makeup people had a spy on the set, and they went back and stole some ideas. But apparently
I'm sure it was all too real for Planet of the Apes. I mean, you need to be able to see Roddy McDowell's eyes, you need to be able to see the humanity in those actors.
But when Dan Richter's touching that scene where they all come in and what your wives would find intrusive sound, is it Ligeti? I can't remember.
I think so.
Touching the slab and just touching it and pulling away and touching it is fantastic.
Yeah.
His performance is, I think, really, really great, actually.
Well, because it's not a human character, we immediately people assumed for years that they were real apes.
Yeah.
There's no appreciation of the performance.
Yeah.
Right? And also, when I return to it, I stop thinking about it after about 30 seconds because I get caught up in the movie again and just watching the entire environmental performance.
Yes.
In fact, I'm really curious to see it in IMAX now because the additional resolution will make, I assume, those backdrops look even more like backdrops, which I don't see on Blu-ray or DVD.
That'll be interesting.
It was visible in 70. It was obvious in 70mm that there are painted backdrops in the desert sequences in the early stuff. But I'd never noticed it until I saw it again as an adult.
Well, they're front projection photographs.
Mm. But there are backdrops, too.
Partly painted.
Yeah, very clearly so.
It always bothered me a little bit later on when I knew more about, early man. Is that it bothered me that they were totally in desert. They should have been in steppe. But it's a minor thing, but they went to Namibia and filmed all that. It's very much... just speaking about the coldness,
sure.
There's a scene where... A very small scene where Frank Poole, Gary Lockwood, is on a tanning bed.
Yes.
And his parents have a birthday message, kind of a performative, a little slightly false little message, video message they send him. And he says, a little flatter, please, Hal. And he's completely unmoved by his parents. And it's weird to say that, but as a kid, that was shocking to me because movies were always about this sort of, parents love their children and everyone likes each other. That sort of coldness. I mean, you see it in, I don't know, Antonioni and other directors for sure. But I hadn't seen it then.
Mm-hmm. And emotional remoteness?
Yeah, and the emotional remoteness throughout, and the individual... Like, Bowman and Poole each have their own little screen, and it's this sort of foretelling of a world of emotional isolation and focusing on screens and being entirely cut off from each other and other people. It's maybe, Kubrick himself, of course, was kind of emotionally remote, although when you actually, privately, I think he was a lot more emotional than he seems. But
have you seen Filmworker, the documentary?
No.
It's about Leon Vitali, who was his go-to, his majordomo for 25 years, really, from Barry Lyndon on. And Vitaly talks about surprising emotional depths. He would set up, while he was shooting, I think it was The Shining, while he was shooting The Shining, he had video monitors set up because one of his cats was dying.
Oh, really?
And he wanted to be able to watch, or dog, but he wanted to be able to watch the pet
right
throughout. And so he had a way of keeping an eye on the animal, and he would be devastated for days after one of his pets died and that stuff. So, yeah, I think...
Obviously loved his daughter. His daughter appears in 2001 in a very nice little sequence.
But it's still another scene of a parent separated from a child.
Yeah, that's right.
When you point that out on a video screen. I think part of it is that maybe he is trying so hard to remove himself emotionally from the films he makes. He was a very cerebral filmmaker, very, very clinical setups and studies and, you know, the God's eye views and the tracking shots and the sense of control and command. But I think, like, the more I learn about him after the camera stopped rolling, the more fascinated I am.
I found that Clockwork Orange to be, after 2001, I was young, disappointing. Mm-hmm. Very impressive, but also just very so dark, such a dark vision. I guess that they've all been dark, really.
Yeah, I mean, he made Strangelove before.
Well, Strangelove is of course, I think, the perfect film. I think it's an extraordinary film, and this, having just seen The Death of Stalin, it's the only other film I've seen that manages to have that balance of horror and real hilarity.
Yeah.
But Strangelove is, and of course, Strangelove has one of the greatest deaths in movie history, as Colonel Kong rides the H-bomb down, and then 2001 has another of the great Hal's death in the red computer room, and those little touches, like the little plexiglass
the slides
just coming out so slowly afterwards, and him slowly. Deteriorating and dying in front of us, mm-hmm. is very it's very touching,
yeah.
And the song he sings, by the way, is the first song, Daisy, Give Me Your Answer, Dude, is the first song that a computer generated voice ever sang of Marvin Minsky. Oh, who is it? Like which you know, one of the great giants of early computers, mm-hmm. in the early 60s. So he actually
used... So it predates 2001. He actually used the thing.
Yeah, he actually did. He actually did use it, yeah.
That's great. I think, too, that the thing about that sequence now, it feels like watching someone succumb to dementia. It's really...
Yes.
Like, the older I've gotten, the more... Yes. The more loss you experience, like, the changes the way you relate to everything, essentially. But, you know, my grandfather had pretty profound Alzheimer's. And the first time I saw 2001 after he died... It was unnerving to me to listen to Hal regress.
Yeah.
Because
that's,
you know, my mind is going, I can feel it, it takes on a different texture.
Please stop, Dave.
Yeah.
Please stop.
The pleading is
really
disturbing, especially because he never breaks his tone. His timbre never cracks. And the other, the mirroring of that, too, is the scene you were talking about, Delay's acting in the scene where he's trying to negotiate with Hal to get back in, but his voice never goes up either. It's the most distressing thing about that movie is no one ever raises their voice.
Except the apes.
Right, the apes shriek, and then it goes relatively silent,
yeah.
monotone,
yeah.
Level, and then at the very end we return to the noises that are presumably the aliens, which just sound like furniture being moved and creatures shrieking.
Yeah.
And it's that sine wave is just so odd and clever to bookend it sonically that way.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if it was intentional. It's just the way it works out.
I never thought of that. Yeah, what did you think of the Louis the 14th sort of Trump hotel?
Yeah.
the end.
Hotel is exactly how someone posited in the 70s, I think, that it must have been Harlan Ellison. He wrote about it constantly in the 70s. It's probably a zoo. That, you know, like, this is what it looks like to David Bowman, but it's not like this.
Yes.
And I've always thought that, yeah, it's an idea of refinement. It's not, like, it's clearly not real in the way that, you know, the glass breaks and everything is just sort of fragile. And if he wanted to, he could probably put his hand through the wall and find whatever else is on the other side. But the idea of it being fancy is unnerving in a different way, because everything else we've seen has been really utilitarian and functional.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're in this Baroque room,
yeah,
where everything has curlicues on it and trimmings.
Oh, it's kind of hideous too.
Yeah. Oh, it's vulgar.
Yeah.
But it's too nice to mess up, so you're automatically calmed by it.
Right.
Theoretically, like if you moved into this hotel, you would treat it very nicely, and yeah, Trumpian is exactly right. It's what he thinks looks classy.
Yeah.
And so it's a way of maybe if it's a projection, if it's the thing that's in his head to make him calm.
Yeah.
You move carefully and slowly in a room like that. And it's very, very clever.
And it's that sequence where he's looking, he's in the pod looking out, and he sees himself, older, in a spacesuit, looking back, and then you see his point of view, and the pod's disappeared. Then he goes into a room and looks out, and then there's this old man having dinner.
Just the montage.
Each time, and then he turns around so slowly, and then he's gone. Those jumps feel absolutely right. They feel like a dream. And but also, you know, I have to say, like a psychedelic experience. Yeah. And they never did LSD. Kubrick talked about it. I'd never do that. He'd be afraid he'd lose some.
I mean, he's too much of a control freak to ever risk.
Yeah.
Unbalancing.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. And I don't know if Clark ever did, but it's that. But they did research that. They did. There were those early experiments, which were shut down later. With psychedelics, and they were secretly trying to find out about how that worked. And if people, Pauline Kael said again, I think she said that they were, when the first screenings of the movie were disastrous, like half the audience walked out, and all the critics were like totally negative, almost all. And then bit by bit, a younger audience, it felt, I think it was quite generational. I took my dad to see it for about 2 days after I first saw it. Yeah. And he really liked it and respected it, but didn't really, it was completely strange to him. And I think it was a generational shift. And then they marketed it with, I think the log line was...
The Ultimate Trip.
The Ultimate Trip, yeah.
And they sold it as a midnight movie.
Weird. And Pauline Kael said, like, well, going to see a movie because it's like, you take acid before you go see it. That's like going to see a Doris Day, Rock Hudson movie for decorating trips, for decorating tips.
Yeah. Which is, people were doing. So.
Yeah, I guess so.
There was definitely an audience for that, too.
But it did take off. I mean, it did make a lot of money, actually, I think, in the end. It actually was a successful film.
It's the kind of... I wonder if that's it, too. The only way you can relate to the experience, the only way you can describe the experience to someone else is to recontextualize it so radically, because the film had no precedent. Now, you can describe it as a science fiction film, but that's not really what it is. It is still singular. There really isn't anything else like it. There are movies that try to be like it, and then they're like 2001, but they're not 2001.
And they tried, like 2010, they tried to explain it. They tried to be more programmatic and more explicit,
right? Yeah.
More human.
More emotional stakes, the Cold War thing.
Even Cameron, I read recently, he said, oh, you saw it again and thought, yeah, they should have been more emotional in it. Of course...
Nope.
It's this cool look at human beings, where they came from, and where, and also, people play it safe now, the audiences, because evolution is actually controversial.
Yeah.
So you don't actually see films that actually say we were apes, we evolved into humans, because they don't want to, I think this is my theory, that they don't want to be too explicit about that. And that's brave in that way, too. It seems obvious, perhaps, to people who do accept evolution. But it's rare. It's rare in that. Though I do think that there's a lot of emphasis on individualism in the movie and violence, that the ape becomes successful and becomes a technology user, becomes becomes human because he's violent. Mm-hmm. And what we know about evolution is... it's not quite that. It's much more cooperative. It's much more about the group.
Right. But if you're introducing the concept of a monolith, then everything changes, right? It doesn't have to be a direct representation of theory. It's infected by whatever fantastical element you bring to it.
Yeah.
So if the monolith was the uniting force for one tribe, then there you have community work. It's just their group working as a group to kill the other group.
Yeah, that's true. They do go and fight the others as a group. It's but I think it was a much more early vision of the dawn of man, and also just the title. That obviously it's pre-feminist revolution.
Sure.
It's, there's the little girl and
there are presumably
the couple of stewardesses and
and some females in Moonwatcher's tribe. We see like hiding with the babies.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, this is a masculine view of the future, male-dominated, white male-dominated specifically.
Yeah, and the, there's not a single person of color in the...
I think the only other non-white Americans we see are the Russians, and they're just presented as suspicious, creepy guys sneaking around trying to get information. It's a great scene.
Accurate, and Margaret Tizak is the... do bring along that delightful little girl.
Yes.
Leonard Rossiter doing this most unctuous, creepy guy. Mm. Yeah. Who later he used him in Barry Lyndon. But it's a very masculine, very top down kind of world.
Yeah. Well, it grew directly out of the Mad Men reality, where everybody is just a white guy, where they were done in the '60s, and that's in 65. That's what it's going to look like.
That's right. That's right. But it's just to go back to the wonder of it. It was when he cuts inside the Discovery when I was young, and now watching it again, that centrifuge is still amazing. That there's this big wheel which they turn and the camera stays in. The camera turns round, so it looks like the guy's running on a treadmill like a hamster, the actor. But the illusion of that is extraordinary. And the one where Bowman comes out of the pod, climbs down the comes out of the centerpiece, climbs down the ladder, and Poole, whose food is glued to the I mean, the way they did is, I mean, pretty. I suppose it's pretty obvious how they would have done that, but.
But they had to. But seeing it out. It's obvious now. Right?
Yeah, but seeing that for anyone seeing that for the first time, it still is enormously powerful. It still really works, and without, of course, any CGI, any computer generated imagery, without any of that.
Yeah, I had to explain it to, I think it was a nephew of Kate's, maybe, years and years ago now, 10 years.
A nephew of yours?
A nephew of Kate's.
Okay,
my wife's. And he was. Yeah, it was. It was him. He was asking about, you know, why is it so revered? And I was trying to explain that the only other science fiction thing that was of stature at the time was Star Trek, the television series Star Trek, which was in no way a representation of us in the now, in the or humanity. It didn't have, for all of its talk about Strange New Worlds, it had no larger view. It was just, you know, wagon train in space. It was a bunch of people flying around doing stuff.
Right.
And 2001 stopped and thought about what it would actually be like to confront the unknown and to accept that this was happening around us, that, you know, to have real people or human beings plunged into this giant scale adventure. Because Floyd is introduced as a commuter, and suddenly he's dealing with an alien technology that's super secret and all of this stuff. And then he disappears, and then we have these bus drivers, and they're suddenly thrust. Over and over again, we see ordinary people, for their universe, forced to confront something much, much larger than them.
Yeah.
And Star Trek simply, you know, it was a guy with a bump on his head, or it was a woman in a scanty dress with a different skin color, and you know, the Green Lady is the alien. It's not in any way comparable. So to have this come out at a point in time where science fiction was kind of the cheap stepchild of genre.
Yeah.
Just evolving out of the pulp monster movies of the 50s.
Yeah.
It was even more revelatory. And what I was trying to explain to him was that we live in the world that 2001 made.
Yes.
Conceptually.
That's right.
And
that's
then even when Star Trek tried to go back, and when Paramount tried to relaunch Star Trek...
Which they probably wouldn't have done without 2001.
Right. They went with Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Well, yes.
And rather than copy Star Wars, they copied 2001 and tried to do some kind of grand sci-fi humanistic thing with an ambiguous ending and an alien we couldn't fully understand and all of that. And you can see how deeply ingrained Kubrick's vision is, how it reinfected Star Trek,
mm-hmm.
and that Star Trek didn't know how to handle it, so it mm-hmm. treats those ideas as an antibody, and it ultimately rejects them for mm-hmm. the rest of the Star Trek films that came out, which were much more swashbuckly adventure-y.
Yeah.
And it's that's the way I tried to explain it to him, and he sort of understood, I think. But it's almost impossible now to conceive of a world before 2001.
Yeah. Yeah, it started, we now live in a world where, or a cinematic world where there's tons of so-called science fiction
mm.
and tons of space movies, and it really did begin there.
Yeah.
There isn't, I mean, I guess in the 1950s there were those sort of cheap science fiction movies, but yeah, they were all cheap, and and the obsession with which Kubrick pursued this, and everybody who worked on it talks. I mean, you've met, obviously, you know, met Trumbull, and he did a film, Silent Running,
yeah,
and also didn't he do that Brainstorm. Brainstorm.
Yeah, with the show scan process.
Yeah, both of those are kind of interesting films, I think.
Well, they dare to reach for something.
Yeah.
I mean, Silent Running, it's almost a Western, really. It's about an outlaw who goes away on the run with his friends. But it is, the way that it's handled. Yeah, and the other film I always forget to mention is Solaris, of course.
Yes.
Because it is that exact thing where Mosfilm said, make us a 2001.
Right.
And Tarkovsky took it in his own direction.
And he didn't like 2001, I read. And
he made a movie about love, right? He made a 2001 that's all about human emotion.
Yes. It's funny, I never really liked it that much. I don't know why. It was a remade, wasn't it?
Soderbergh.
George Clooney.
Clooney is the lead, yeah. It's great.
Is it?
It's a really underrated film for
Soderbergh. I gotta see it again.
Yeah. It's pretty hard to... Well, it's not hard to find anymore.
Was that one with Jennifer Lawrence and when the guy wakes up...
Oh, Passengers. To Ugh, no.
Yeah, no, but the first half of it kind of worked, I thought, but after that.
Yeah, and right up until it becomes what it is.
And whatever you may argue about, one may argue about the ending of 2001, it's dedicated to a vision, and it may be what, you know, once again, Pauline Kael called it, or somebody called it a Shaggy God story, but...
Yeah, it sounds like Kael.
Yeah, it's... And yeah, I can always see, I can see that. But it remains just enormously powerful. And that, when you're saying that people are confronting things that they don't know, in the sense of alien, they're also confronting a universe that's terrifyingly bleak. I mean, mm-hmm. Just those shots of the moon bus traveling across the lunar landscape... With the screeching choir music going on, it's just unbelievably strange. You cut inside and they're eating sandwiches and talking like U.S. Army guys, and there's this sense of the utter strangeness of it and the utter emptiness of it that I don't think has really been captured since or before.
Alien, maybe. Alien is the film that I think about where all of the sequels have in some way, and I love some of them, but I think all of those films have in some way undermined its power, which is that if you go too far, you'll pay for it.
Yeah.
Just the sense that the universe is filled with these hideous monsters that we just don't know about, and we're so much better off not knowing about them.
Yeah.
2001, I don't think, is quite as cruel. People die horribly and unnecessarily, but there's a reason for it that always comes back to us. Everyone who dies in 2001 dies at a human hand. I mean, they built HAL, so
ultimately
responsible.
I see what you mean.
But the universe doesn't destroy us. It's us. We're our own problem. We're our own worst enemy. We're our own constant problem. And in the end, if you make it all the way to the end of whatever this route is that we follow Bowman onto, you become something else. But you don't die. Like he's
transformed.
Whatever he is still there.
And
that's much more optimistic to me than...
Yeah,
the cold reading.
I suppose so. I mean, Alien is. Alien works for me because of the design and the. I mean, it's sort of a monster in a house movie,
yeah.
right?
But Stephen King said perfectly, like, it's a haunted house film. It just you can't leave the house because the house is in space.
Yeah, yeah. Although I remember being annoyed because I said, no, you shouldn't have when the spaceship blows up, it should be silent.
Yeah.
Because in 2001, I. For a brief time, I hung out with the director, Brian De Palma. Oh, yeah. And he was making Mission to Mars. And I said, oh, you've got to do what 2001 does. You know, you've got to make it silent. But he didn't.
Yeah. Although that one scene with the plummet to Mars where the...
Oh, yeah.
The rope misfires and Tim Robbins is like 20 feet away from salvation for a good 6 or 8 minutes. That's pretty damn close.
Yeah, yeah. No, and the Alien films are it's another one that was launched by 2001, I don't think those... And then what about Close Encounters? Where would you see that fitting into the whole alien-human...
I think, well, it's also deeply optimistic.
I love the film, actually. I like it very much.
But it's a human lens straight through. Like, it's an Earthbound film where the aliens come to us.
Yeah.
But as far as giant meditative entertainments, it's practically the only other film I would hold up with 2001. And they're so different, but they are ultimately asking the same question, which is, who are we and what are we doing here? Just in very, very different ways.
Yeah, I remember that my feeling about it was you know, I was judgmental of Alien because it came out, I don't know if it came out, but I saw it right after Close Encounters. It must have been the same year, or within a year.
Summer of 79, so a year and a half.
Yeah, a year and a half, yeah. And I remember being like, oh, there was this great sort of hopeful feeling which came out, which was sort of subsequent to Star Wars, which... When I saw it, I was old enough to sort of recognize all the World War II stuff and the Western stuff and just saw it as a fun pastiche and not really a serious film, you know. Yeah. And I guess I was more judgmental in those days or something, but I was angry because I was a peace activist. And the Evil Empire stuff,
right,
with the very clear references to the Soviet Union and then Reagan picked up those terms. Yeah. He picked up the term Evil Empire and he referenced, and people immediately picked up his defense initiative, you know, having weapons in space and as called it Star Wars. And I saw it as a negative thing, that our vision of the future was endless war. And I still see it that way, actually. Yeah. I still see it that way. Star Trek at least is, well, we're going somewhere. It's a journey. Well, Star Wars is like, it's endless war. It's like the apes around the watering hole in 2001. That's the vision of the future. And 2001 and Close Encounters are much more positive visions. You could argue that Close Encounters is a bit too Spielberg, a bit too cuddly or whatever, but I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, I love it. I just, frankly, like a child, love that film.
Yeah, so do
I. And 2001, going back to it, it's colder and it's, you know, Nietzschean and you know, we need to become Superman, and it's scary, but it feels like I said, that tanning bed scene with Poole, that it, those kind of human the coldness of human interactions carries a truth about our world, and certainly carries a truth about space that is as fresh now, when I watched it the other night, is as fresh now as it was 50 years ago.
Yeah, it doesn't... I mean, it dates in a way because the whiteness of it and the very clean-cut ideas and visions, but
oh, yeah,
its vision of the future is from 1968, but it also feels now, because we've surpassed it chronologically and we know that that's not our future, it's easier to deal with somehow. It feels like a film from an alternate timeline.
Yeah.
Where, oh yeah, if we'd stayed on the space race, if we'd actually continued, if the Apollo program hadn't ended and NASA hadn't just pivoted to the space shuttle, which was inspired apparently by 2001.
Really?
Well, supposedly the designs originally looked much more like the Clipper. It's a fascinating thing now because it looks like nothing else and remains distinct. Like, there is no other film like it. Even the sequel approximates some of its framing, but that's the most...
I should see that again. It's been years since I've seen it.
It's fine.
Yeah,
it is. It's fine, and there's some really nice small moments between the actors where they're just clearly filling time in the midsection. Mm. But yeah, it just, again, it tries to unknit one of the greatest questions ever asked, and it's not going to be a satisfying resolution.
No, it probably didn't. You know, I can see why they made it commercially, but it didn't really need that. But you know, science fiction is, of course, always really, really bad at predicting the future.
Yeah,
but it. When it gets some things right, where it's fantastic, but yeah, it was the world has changed enormously. You said about the white man thing. I was just remembering that the year before it came out, the Expo 67 in Montreal was called Man and His World.
Oh yeah,
and so it's the whole culture was like that, but it's so you know we've moved on from that a lot, but it is I do kind of regret the loss of that optimistic spirit. You can see it in the design, you know, in the design of the chairs, the whole, well, let's just be logical, let's make things bright, let's make them clean and mass produced, and
functional and comfortable, which seems to be important in the future.
Yeah. And the practicality of everything, just the idea of the space wheel and the centrifuge and the creature comforts that they have, but everything bright and white and nothing shadowed, and all of it, nothing like that room, nothing like a comfy couch.
Yeah.
But there's something optimistic and I think exciting about that we've lost. But actually, that was that little rant was sort of incoherent.
I understand it completely.
Yeah, I think what I mean is just there was a tremendous optimism which we you know politically we feel like we're just lost.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I was just reading that Cooper tried to get insurance in case aliens were discovered before he released the film.
I think I read about that.
So that was the optimism that they had. They actually thought we were on the brink of that. And
imagine a time where that sort of news would be singular. I mean, now, at this point, right now, in our technological state, I think if Twitter just started to spread the story, oh, by the way, aliens,
yes,
it would just be like, oh, great. Now what? One more thing.
Really?
I think every science fiction film regards the revelation of alien life as either something wonderful or something horrible.
You know, but they're impactful.
Yeah, they're either going to invade us and destroy us, or they're here and what do we do?
Yeah.
And I think right now, if there were aliens discovered, we would all just be like, oh, Jesus Christ, what do they want? Like, what is it now? It's one more thing.
One more thing to worry about.
Because that's the thing, too. Like,
stimulating.
Yeah, everybody's talking about how Area 51, you know, the super secret place where they've hidden the aliens. Conspiracy theory is over now, because there's no way, if Trump knew about it, he wouldn't say it. It would come out.
That's true.
He can't not say. People, did you know? A lot of people didn't know there's aliens. He would have said it.
I think Obama said it. It's the question he got asked the most by ordinary people.
See, that I get.
The truth is, yeah. Yeah, it would be interesting. We'll see, or we won't see.
Just the idea that they're gatekeepers.
Arthur Clarke said, either we're alone in the universe or we're not. And either way, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's necessarily terrifying, but
I think our current technological status, which is that we are broadcasting television and radio into the universe, you know, for decades now, I think that kind of proves that if there is intelligent life out there, they want nothing to do with us.
Yeah.
What
was that movie where those teenage aliens came down because they'd seen...
Dante's Explorers, right?
Was it?
Yeah, big puppet aliens.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, there's Galaxy Quest.
Oh, God bless.
Which is great.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
The third act, maybe not.
But... Oh, no, it's great. It ends like a Star Trek movie.
It is so
completely committed to that,
yes,
to that bit.
And the aliens were... I can't remember the actors who did that. But
Enrico Colantoni, who sat where you're sitting right now.
Oh, really?
Came in and did the show a couple of years back.
Oh, cool.
And he devised the Thermians. He was the one who came up with the physicality in his audition. And
we
basically... And the filmmakers basically said to every other actor, you do that. Do what he's doing. That's the alien.
Right.
And it's Rainn Wilson and Missy Pyle and Jed Rees, I think, is in there somewhere. And we were talking about, he picked Midnight Run, and we were talking about that. And at one point in the recording, you can hear me kind of go, and he says, do you mind if I talk about Galaxy Quest for a second? And I got so excited. Like, oh, no, please carry on. That's a wonderful vision of human alien cooperation.
Yeah.
They're dumber than we are.
Yeah.
But
they were so innocent and they were so hopeful that they'd have this hero Yeah, it was very funny. Yeah. And Alan Rickman was hilarious.
Oh, yeah. And it has that magnificent... It's Colin Tony who does it, that magnificent pop culture moment where it all crashes together. And it's like, what about Gilligan's Island? And they just go quiet, those poor people.
That's funny.
Yeah.
And then it was like, Earth Girls Are Easy, because that Jim Carrey's tongue.
Oh, yeah.
Is what I remember from that movie.
Yeah, the big trailer moment.
Yeah.
But we don't know how to deal with alien intelligence as narrative, really. It's always, because we're human, we always turn it back on us. It's a catalyst for human behavior.
It's either, when it's successful, it's funny, like in Galaxy Quest, or it's, I did think Arrival came close.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But, and Close Encounters came close in a way, you know, it did.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the time, when you I just was watching David Attenborough, Blue Planet, you know, yeah. and the creatures, or if you look at microscopic diatoms and so forth, they're way more interesting than the creatures in our own. The creatures of our own planet are usually more interesting and more imaginative than the ones that the latex and CGI well, folks now, produce.
CGI has made anything possible, and we're still using it to create.
Yeah,
you know,
to create guys with rubber like.
Motion capture people. Yeah.
Yeah. But let me just ask you about
sure.
other films that are kind of one-offs that, and I was thinking of The Tree of Life,
mm-hmm.
a fairly recent film by Terrence Malick.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a kind of a love it or hate it thing. I loved it.
I did as well. I was absolutely, about 3 minutes in, I was interested. And then after another five, it was just like, oh, I get it. We're just going there.
You just have to go with it, yeah.
But he finally made the movie he's always been making.
Yeah.
Which was the real discovery, I think, that he could simply tell the story about himself and his youth and the things he thought about.
Yeah.
And that somehow unlocks the entire universe. And the question of whether dinosaurs had mercy and compassion. It's like, well, why wouldn't they? I mean, because they're not us, so we assume they can't. But, you know, anybody who's ever had a dog or a cat will tell you that animals are completely capable of inner lives.
Yeah, as an advanced animal, but it was a reach, but it mm. I just went
but at
with
that
it
point
too.
In the film
yeah.
you either
you just go with it yeah,
yeah.
And you yeah it was, and it had the sort of sense of the divine and grace. It had those that feeling of mm. of wonder that you know puts it in a way in the same kind of category of brave yeah. films that actually try to get at the wonder of the universe.
Yeah. And the,
as opposed to being, you know, plot driven and cynical and
explosion based.
Explosion based is a good phrase. Yeah, yeah. But do you know? You must know, of course, a movie that I admire that is listed as one of the worst movies of all time, which is Zabriskie Point.
Sure. Yeah.
That's a film that, when I was a kid, being an immigrant, it was the first film that. Looked like, felt like North America felt to me.
Oh, really?
The world that I'd been, this alien world I'd been dropped into, where everything was different from England. It superficially the same, but fundamentally different, mm-hmm. felt different. So Zabriskie Point seemed to capture that, I guess because he was an Italian, that sense of a world that was entirely alien.
Mm-hmm.
And
kind of hypersaturated and hypersaturated, overwhelming and...
Yeah,
and rich is the wrong word, but
and nasty,
extra. Yeah, everything
it was very.
The
Lord of Los Angeles was horrific to me in that movie.
Mm.
I mean, it's. I think it's a silly movie in some ways, but everything blowing up at the end.
The stylization kind of pushes too far towards the end, I think. But
it has that. It is like 2001. It has all this, you know. Just whoa, that's the ending of this film. Everything's going to blow up.
Yeah.
What do you think of it?
It's been forever since I've seen it. I remember just thinking, it's like, yeah, that's what happens when Antonioni tries to make a statement about America. But I don't have the same relationship to the material.
Yeah.
And I saw it much later.
Yeah.
I must have seen it in the 90s, whenever the first widescreen version came out.
Yeah.
So I was already in my late 20s when I saw it, and it was, you know, it was already an artifact.
Yeah, absolutely. And it would seem all that revolutionary violence and... justification for violence is you know, I'm against it. You know, mm-hmm. I don't agree with it.
Yeah, it feels like a weird, like an answer song to Godard's Weekend in a weird way.
Yeah.
Just like, you know what? I'll show you the sick soul of Western culture.
Yeah.
This is it. No, this is it. Well, I got one. And
yeah.
And so forth down the road. But yeah, I definitely can see the 2001 connection in the general existentialism at the end and just the sense of, well, I can't answer everything, so I'm just going to end it all. 2001 has an answer, but we aren't allowed to see it.
Yeah.
It's not a shrug. And it gets this big triumphant finale.
Now, in Arthur Clarke's book, I think those satellites going around the Earth were originally supposed to be
nuclear platforms.
Which
detonates them all.
I never understood that they were meant to be nuclear bombs until... And they don't detonate in the movie because Kubrick thought, wait a minute, I just ended the movie with nuclear bombs going off. I don't want to do that again. Yeah.
But it's actually better if it's a completely unreadable ending. If we don't know what that thing is going to do or what it wants or even what it is. I still find it... I know it's a model. I know it's a little dummy head. But every time it turns to look at the camera, it just...
They
body chills.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They tried to get a fetus.
I know.
This is... a real fetus. But they also apparently... heated up or something on set. And fluid started to come out of the dummy's eyes. It was crying. And there was a Roman Catholic stagehand who screamed and ran out of the room. The audience was witnessing a miracle. Mm. But it's, you know, people who get... Everyone who worked on the film, and Kubrick was obviously in many ways, you know, an autocrat and was very stingy with credits and money, and he had a difficult relationship with Arthur Clarke. But everybody who talks about it, and even at the time, I think they knew that it was really something special and were really giving it everything. I'm sure Trumbull must have said because he got into a dispute with Kubrick about the credits, but
special photographic effects was it?
Kubrick said special effects directed by Stanley Kubrick, devised and directed.
Yeah,
but you know, sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what I think. We'll never, like everything with Kubrick, right? There's a million different interpretations and there are different stories about everything. And yeah, he probably. Made sure that his imprint was more prominent in the marketing and the release and everything else. Mm. And then by refusing to do interviews after the fact, it's just brilliant. You know, he becomes the vacuum that draws all the attention.
The slab.
But I think exactly right that he is the monolith. Mm. There is no way around it.
Mm.
It would not exist without him. Like this film wouldn't be.
No.
It would never. First of all, it would never have been made. But also, it would simply not be this. Without his perspective and the fact that you can look at all of his movies from, you know, well, from this onwards, that's where he settled into the Steadicam thing and really understood what it was he wanted to do with the dollies and the omniscience.
Mm.
Clockwork Orange follows, Barry Lyndon follows. They all come from here. This was the pivot point in his cinema.
Yeah.
You know, Lolita and Dr. Strangelove are very much his movies. But his style is still looser, rougher.
Yeah.
Just less formed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he never worked in scope again, which is something that I always found fascinating.
Really?
Yeah. Subsequently, all of his films were 178, 185, depending on whether you believe Leon Vitali or not.
Well, isn't Barry Lyndon really wide, super wide?
No.
Can't remember.
No, it's 166, apparently.
Okay.
If you believe Leon Vitali, who was arguing for that when the Restoration came out.
But I do find those films less compelling. And Barry Lyndon is incredible. I always thought it was like looking down. You know how when you look at the wrong end of a telescope and you get these sort of miniature pictures, even though it's big? It felt like I was looking down one of those into the 18th century. It felt, I suppose, like looking into space. I felt like I was really looking into space with 2001. With Barry Lyndon, I really felt I was looking at the 18th century more than any other movie I've ever seen.
Hmm. And it's the tableau effect. They're just
so perfectly. And of course, you know, the super fast lenses they built with the lighting.
Candle lighting.
The gaffers must have gone nuts, you know, lighting the candles and everything. But at the same time, it's an oddly distancing film. Except for the final duel, which is riveting in the way that. Bowman trying to get into the ship is riveting. It's stunning, but
otherwise it's a very poised film.
Yeah,
And
I always thought that was intentional to make it all look like paintings. Everybody's being very still, but
how do you engage emotionally?
Exactly,
with that?
Create stasis. You can't help but do it.
What's it? A Ryan O'Neill, mm-hmm. and you know, not. Well, he's fine, I suppose.
Yeah, for what that is. Everybody's giving exactly the performance that Kubrick demands, which is kind of the problem. His vision of it is so static. I felt the same way about Eyes Wide Shut. For all the forward motion, it's just, it's cold. It's, I mean, that's the cold one of his.
It's also silly, this conspiracy stuff. It's kind of silly. Like, why would he think that?
I think it was Ebert who said it was the work of a man who hadn't left his house in 20 years, which I think is a really nice way to put it. It's just someone who has been left alone with his thoughts for way too long.
Right.
I bet they just sit around and have naked woman parties. That's what it is. And then...
Yes.
And write it. That's what they do.
That's, I'm sure. I wish I was there.
Least convincing New York film I've ever seen.
Bohemian Grove sort of nonsense.
Yeah.
But it's, there's also, what was this? It was Clockwork Orange. There's a Shining, which I never was in love with. I know it's a terrible thing to say, but
it's fine.
I didn't find it that scary, and I didn't find it that engaging. Yeah. But
I mean, Stephen King famously hated it, and as an adaptation. And I think, while I think he's wrong about why it isn't a fair adaptation, I think it's an excellent adaptation of elements of the book.
Yeah,
but he said something really brilliant about it, which is that Stanley Kubrick made a horror movie, but he doesn't know what a horror movie is. That it's his impression of a horror film.
There was a movie called The Haunting back probably early mid '60s.
Oh yeah. Rather wise.
I remember that being far more terrifying, I thought, than and there's Psycho's scarier, but all those film, Clockwork Orange is powerful. It feels nasty, but it's powerful. But and I'd love to see Barry Lyndon again in a proper, does it exist in a good
Criterion put it out last year?
Yeah. So I should see it again, but they didn't have the power for me of Paths of Glory, of Dr. Strangelove, or 2001. And I think it is because of that. He became a guy directing too remotely.
Mm. So, I mean, in a weird way, this does kind of bring me to the final question of the podcast, which is always, like, is there anything of 2001 that you've used, borrowed, incorporated, stolen into your own creative DNA? Is there some expression of it in your work?
That's an interesting question, and I should have anticipated it. I remember you asked that. Yeah, of course. Very obliquely, I would say that in preparing for the conversation, I read about it and I've always had this image of Kubrick as this monolith and a kind of terrifying figure as a director. If you're trying to make films, you know, there's this guy who's supremely confident and directs, his absolutely dedicated to his vision, is unafraid of producers, keeps them away. And I feel like, oh, I'm completely the opposite. I just want to please everybody. I'm terribly insecure about what I'm doing and nervous all the time. And then reading about him from his wife and other testimony, realizing that actually he was very much sometimes full of shame and oh, I'm just screwing up. And then stays up late at night and then finds a way to, yeah, maybe this will work, but is always doubting it. Mm. It's like, Ira Glass of This American Life said, all stories actively want to suck. And that's true. That is true. Everything wants to suck. It has a suck force. And Kubrick was fighting that as much as he was presenting this image of, he was dealing with his own insecurities and his own difficulties. I remember reading about David Lean having crying jags. I was like, really?
Yeah,
amazing.
That's something that I've never fully reconciled myself with.
Yes, because the arrogance and the assuredness. So it's funny, but so I would say that reading about Kubrick has been a takeaway for me in a very positive way, thinking like, oh, okay, even he was worried about it. And in terms of the actual film, I'm a documentarian, and nothing that I've done has the sort of visual, would have that kind of visual power. But I do think, I would say, once or twice, there's been
a cut that's excited me, or I mean, in the cutting room and thinking, I can do that, and this will actually work. And that does derive in a way from those,
yeah,
well,
the splices, the jumps.
Yeah, that there's that extraordinary cut from the bone to the spaceship, or the cut, the use of sound, and I have. I remember thinking, yeah, that could work. That could do a cut like that, and that's those are the ones that come into my mind. Or Peter O'Toole blowing out the match in Lawrence.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so in those oblique ways, I would say it has, and also just perhaps in having the courage to try to make a film about something absolutely fundamental. Fundamental questions about who we are and where are we going, where we've come from and who we are and where we're going, and to have the courage to look at those fundamental questions, very large questions. So there, I think it has affected me.
I'm always happy, you know, I'm happy when there's a concrete answer for that question, and also when there is a really roundabout way of
right.
coming to that realization. I mean, the movies that inspire us don't always inspire us immediately, right? Like, they just sort of percolate. And this film in particular, 50 years on, I can only imagine how many people have taken away something for themselves that is so completely different from the person sitting next to them or the person who's outside the house and watching it in another room or something like that. It's just, this movie is the thing that I can't imagine not having it in the back of your mind somewhere at any creative pursuit if you,
yeah.
you know, if you love it that much.
Yeah, absolutely. And the sense of humanness. I mean, I made a film about a personal film searching for my sperm donor, and who had 500 to 1,000 children. And those questions of origin and connectedness to DNA going back to the dawn
mm-hmm.
of humans, and who we are really has informed me all my life, and it, I would say more the meaning than the technique. I've never built. Actually, there was one we did to recreate sperm going into the vagina with a turkey baster kind of thing.
Okay.
We actually did use a technique. I'd forgotten that. It's a very minor thing, but putting a lot of light onto a glass jar, shooting milk into water and filming it in slow-mo
okay.
and then compositing that into a constructed background with inside the vagina. That actually we did. We did think of 2001 and how they did those effects very early on, because we didn't have access to that massive CGI.
Huh.
I'd forgotten that. That's true. But it's more the meaning, I think. I think the film inspires a sense of meaning.
I mean, there are worse goals than searching forever, right? I mean, to continue to explore the nature of everything.
Yeah, the big questions. The big questions. I mean, really, you know, if you're going to try to make things, then sooner or later you pretty well have to wrestle with that.
Yeah.
I guess you don't have to.
No, I mean, but plenty of people don't.
Yeah, yeah.
I like the other guy's movies more.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
My thanks to Barry Stevens, whose documentary Prosecutor is currently available on Amazon Prime. You can also find his TV series War Story streaming on history.ca. You can follow Barry on Twitter at Barry K. Stevens, all one word. And, of course, you can find 2001 A Space Odyssey on Blu-ray and DVD from Warner Home Entertainment. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play, but you might want to wait for the new 4K edition coming in October. And, of course, the film makes its IMAX 70mm debut this Friday, August 24th, at the Ontario Place Cinesphere in Toronto, the AMC Universal CityWalk in Los Angeles, the AMC Metreon in San Francisco, and the AMC Lincoln Square in New York. If you can, go. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner, and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Simcast. SEMcast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever you enjoy the show, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps, it truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.